welcome along to another episode of Glow West, where we talk about sex, sexuality and the body with me, Dr. Caroline West. Glow West is part of the Tortoise Shack Network, and you can support us by rating and reviewing on iTunes or following on Spotify. Today's topic is related to Pride, even though Pride Month is finished up now, but the issues that get discussed at Pride don't magically disappear at the end of June. This Pride Month has been a little bit different, with no parades, but there's also been a huge emphasis on black LGBTQIA people, given the protests in the wake of George Floyd's death in the US. And while Black Lives Matter might not be trending as much now, all the issues haven't gone away, and it's important to keep that conversation going. To talk about this from an Irish perspective, I'm joined today by a volunteer organisation who are really doing amazing activist and advocacy work in Ireland. Black Pride Ireland is a grassroots organisation by queer black people for queer black people on the island of Ireland. Established in 2019 by Ryan A and Diane Bammy McKay, the group works towards the improvement of social and material conditions for the black LGBTQIA plus community in Ireland, including but not limited to the abolition of direct provision and better healthcare for trans people. So Diana and Ryan, thanks a mil for joining me today. How are you both?
We're doing good.
No, thanks a lot. You're busy bees, so thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to me. But you're pure babies, 2019, so you're only gone around a year or so. Talk to me about the kind of work that you do and what you've managed, because you've done a lot in the space of a year. You've kind of started with a bang, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. So we started out around last August, the Galway Pride, where we first marched. And that was kind of, like, as far as we know, the first sort of presence for a specifically black LGBTQIA group in Ireland. And it was really cool. I mean, it was raining because it's Galway, but, like,
of course,
like, I'm not, we had such a good time. And, like, just knowing that something's about to start, like, just it's so great, you know? And then from then on, we just kind of went to, like, we did a fundraiser, and then we've just been kind of working on actually establishing ourselves and what we're about and sort of how we're going to, like, move on forward from here.
Cool. And then, so as you said, you only launched August, so you're not even quite a year, but obviously the last month or so, or even maybe 6 weeks, have been quite intense given the protests that are happening in the US around George Floyd, and you were very instrumental in organizing a protest at the US Embassy in Dublin to reflect on that. Talk to me about that protest and how that went and the conversations that you had leading up to it, and that, I suppose, the need for that protest.
Well, the protest was something that happened very quickly. It was a collaboration with MASI, Movement of Asylum Seekers Ireland, and with Merge as well, who are migrants and ethnic minorities for reproductive justice. And yeah, it was something that happened very, very quickly, but we knew that we had to respond to the events that, you know, our siblings, our black siblings in the States were experiencing, because, you know, just because there is that distance between us doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't some shared struggles, at least in some regards, happening here in Ireland. And yeah, we braved the pandemic, the ongoing pandemic, but, you know, it was for something that we believe is so, so important. And though the actual, the actual reason that we were organizing, that we were mobilizing then, was in response to George Floyd's death, but also to shed even more light on the horror of direct provision, the direct provision system, and kind of the abhorrent treatment that almost everybody undergoes in direct provision. I feel yet that it's still an issue that a lot of people aren't quite up to speed on. It's an issue that a lot of people sort of dismiss. This is something that we briefly mentioned talking in the This Land documentary, but the sort of idea of direct provision, the system it is, the institute of it, is something that is kept largely on the fringes. It's not, you know, the hot button topic in, you know, a lot of Irish political circles. It's something that still remains kind of the reserve of grassroots organizers like ourselves or MASI or Merge. So, you know, with this protest, it kind of had a dual function, you know, responding to the states and the events, but also bringing to light, well, I mean, people in Ireland, some people in Ireland have already been aware of the direct provision system, not least the people who actually live in it. But, you know, we wanted to use this opportunity or this protest as an opportunity to also talk about DP more and to highlight one of the most unfortunate incidents that happened in DP, which was the death of Silva Tequila last year in a DP centre in Galway, who, you know, was a black trans woman that died in the centre. She'd been placed in an all-male direct provision centre, even though she was a woman. She had been buried without the knowledge of her friends. She was buried without the knowledge of her friends, her kin. So yeah, these are kind of the things that we touch on in the manifesto when we talk about the betterment of the quality of life for Black LGBTQIA plus people here, particularly trans people. But yeah, sort of the system of DP was something that we wanted to talk about with the protest too.
Do you think that it's almost easier for people in Ireland to say, oh, look, this is happening in America, let's protest and this is horrible, while at the same time, we've turned a blind eye to direct provision, basically, in Ireland? You know, the media has, or again, like you said, it's essentially grassroots organisations really fighting for those rights. So is it a case of, oh, I'm really upset about that, but the things that we can actually work on, we're not quite as keen on?
I think, like, people don't realize that anti-blackness is this very global concept in the first place. So when we, you know, when we go out to protest for George Floyd's murder, we're not just that, like, that situation isn't just an individual, like, secular, like, event, you know, it's been happening and it still happens as we speak. Like, for example, in Brazil, there is, like, a scary statistic about 23 Black men die every like 10 minutes or something very jarring like wow. that. And I was just like, okay, so yeah. We're living in this world that it's just a constant machine of how to like dehumanize and how to sort of alienate Black people on and on for many, many centuries. So when we're just talking about like direct provision, or we're just talking about, you know, the high policing of Black communities, it's not just that. The conversation is much, much bigger than that. It's also about how Ireland was involved in the slave trade. It's also about how Ireland continually benefits from white supremacy and from being in the EU and just for its sort of proximity to whiteness. Because at some point, I suppose Irish people weren't even considered white because they were considered as other. And it was like the Anglo-Saxons, I suppose, that were white. And then as like economic benefits went and as the world progressed, they just had sort of found themselves closer, closer to that, I don't know, nationality. I don't know what to explain as ethnicity. So like when we're just, you know what, like I just feel like even just talking about direct provision isn't enough, because we need to sort of answer to Ireland's just kind of wicked past. And that includes the Magdalene laundries, which is something that's been considered whitewashed, but you'd never see like the struggles like the biracial kids went through that system, you know? So I feel like we have a lot of catching up to do in terms of accountability and in terms of educating. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. But,
no, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's an underestimation, you're absolutely right, of like anti-blackness in Ireland and racism in Ireland, because a lot of the discourse, you know, I think in the media, people rush to say, okay, quick, I need a black person to have a quote in the media. Yeah. And then, yeah. But then all the comment sections were like, we don't have racism in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm sure you were smacking your head off a wall going for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Of course there is. But that ignorance is still there. And I suppose, because like you don't hear black voices as regularly in the media, and if it is, it's only in relation to maybe something like direct provision. Mm-hmm. That spectrum of experiences isn't really represented.
Of course. I think even like when we are brought over, it's never really the on-ground activists. It's whoever is palatable and whoever is most like, you know, middle of the road politics. It's not radical enough, yeah, like to the degree where we should be at. So even then, it's kind of like a lose-lose situation for us, because in the end, our voices aren't really being heard. They're just being made like more suitable for the white gaze. So I don't know what you think about that, Diana, but
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there is a tendency for, you know, the voices who are the Black voices who are already in Irish media to kind of, I suppose, steer a bit clear of talking about race because, you know, it is such a contentious topic. And maybe people do it to preserve their careers or, you know, to see, not to seem polarizing or things like this. But unfortunately, that does lead to a sort of dilution of the real discourse that we should be having. So like Rayanne said there, it's not radical enough. It doesn't include enough sort of, I suppose, critical or material analysis of conditions in Ireland. It's often very, you know, show racism a red card and, you know, racism is bad, don't do it. But there isn't further nuance to that. There isn't a real analysis of, you know, systems like BHSC or indeed direct provision or education or really the myriad kind of systems that are at play, you know, in social life that kind of contribute to the persistence of anti-Blackness in Ireland. And I feel like the work that we do at BPI is helping to at least bring that to the fore and not just have these very sort of milquetoast, boring discussions about racism. Like, we already know that racism is bad, you know, we don't need a refresher course on that. You know, we know that already, but, you know, there needs to be further action taken beyond that. You know?
Yeah. And I like, you know, some of the I suppose the goals that you were talking about and the work that you do is raising awareness of things such as being anti-capitalist. So I feel that people have heard that expression a lot given the protests lately and things like abolish the police and not really maybe have an understanding of what that actually means. And then obviously, you know, if you're just seeing anti-capitalist, it's like, oh, you want to like, would you want to live in a communist world? Because that didn't work. And it's like, it's obviously a lot more in depth and nuanced then, yeah, we'll just go to communism, that's fine. So can you explain what you mean by being anti-capitalist, especially within, I suppose, an Irish context?
Oof, I think it's like unlearning absolutely everything that we came to know, which I know seems like a hard statement, and like it seems like it's impossible to see an alternative. But I mean, there's way more humane things of doing a lot of the things that we already engage in, you know? And it's, I think it's very important to first note that like capitalism cannot exist without exploitation. Capitalism cannot exist without racism. Capitalism cannot exist without sexism and so on and so forth. Like all these isms that we have really are like a product of like a vile system that will literally self-destruct with unity and will self-destruct with sort of bonding and just latching on to each other instead of corporations. We've gotten to the point, like, it's late stage capitalism, basically, where we're like, money isn't even a real thing. We're kind of like dealing with future money that could exist if, you know, five multinationals got their crap together and moved forward, you know? So I think it's just very scary when you notice that anything we're dealing with isn't real or tangible, you know? When I tell you money is fake, money is fake. So it's uncomfortable and we're going to have to do a lot of like education about like alternatives. Even I don't know all the answers and I'm not a capitalist, I'm anti-capitalist, but I'm still like, you know, it's scary, but I think it's one of those things that's very important to point out in the very beginning of our movement in order for people to get the message, because we can't say stop racism without saying stop capitalism. Mm. No.
Do you think the green movement is kind of gone that way as well? Because they've been good at pointing out, you know, your Penny's t-shirt that's a fiver is made in a sweatshop in Bangladesh. So you know, and the ones that say I'm a feminist on it, it's like, well, you can't really wear a feminist t-shirt for a fiver without knowing the history of like what's behind it. So is there a potential to team up with the green movement, or is there just a lot of greenwashing that goes on as well?
I think there's a lot of whitewashing that goes on in the green movement as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
all the colors. Yeah.
Like this is actually quite like a personal thing for me. It gets me really angry, but it's the whole like, oh, let's use bamboo sticks and like let's use banana plate leaves as plates. And but I'm like, okay, but the people, the indigenous people of the world in Africa and like the Amazon have been saying that for years. So now you turning around and acting like it's this brand new object is really just a new form of green capitalism. And that's a lot, I feel, what I've been seeing, like the whole discourse with the metal straws versus plastic straws, and then we find out like the plastic straws are actually, I mean, metal straws are worse, blah blah blah. And I'm like, see, there has to be a lot more nuance in this conversation, because I feel we're getting a repackaged form of capitalism that I personally do not appreciate. So yeah, I think we can work together, but with a lot of talk and honesty about race and how it affects these movements and who the destruction that's currently happening is affecting, because it's definitely not us here in the West, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Diana?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that there is a lot of whitewashing within the sort of eco-feminist or eco-consciousness movement, and a lot of co-opting of like indigenous ideas and practices and things like that. And I think it's really important before we can, you know, talk about any sort of real, I don't want to say reform, but any sort of real radical, tangible change when it comes to the environment, we have to look at the relationships that Indigenous people and people outside of the West, people in the Global South, have had with nature, with the environment for thousands of years, you know, established kind of pre-colonial relationships that exist there. That were then subsequently raised down by, you know, the introduction of like industrialization and the 24-hour clock and things like that. So yeah, I definitely think unless there is a meaningful engagement with people in the Global South, with Indigenous communities, with Black communities, if there isn't a meaningful engagement there and a willing acknowledgement, then, you know, it's kind of a moot movement. You know, it's kind of pointless, because, you know, Indigenous people and people of color were kind of the original like eco warriors, basically. They were kind of the first champions of the environment, whether it's, you know, Africa, whether it's in the Amazon in South America, whether it's in Indigenous communities in Australia, New Zealand, or in Canada and Greenland. Like, these people kind of paved the way for what we understand to kind of be the modern eco-conscious, eco sort of green movement nowadays. So yeah, I definitely think that there needs to be a proper integration of those ideas and those practices before, you know, we can move forward. And, you know, I don't know if it's something that's being widely practiced now. I don't think it's something that, you know, is getting as much attention as it should be, but I hope that changes in the future.
Yeah. And I think hopefully the movements at the moment are bringing that out into a lot more consciousness rather than, yeah, it's going to move from a slogan on a protest billboard to actual real movements. And then go on.
Yeah, no, I just think it's also important to note that our like interpersonal relationship with like the earth and nature is also very warped. And if you've been privileged enough to sort of learn about those things, about like how to connect with the earth and like how to actually take care of it and understand that it sustains you as much as you sustain it, like just that very, on that very basic level, has been gone for how long, you know? Because even you see like just like the way the world treats like one half versus the other is kind of scary. I actually learned this the other day that Nigeria has one of the biggest dumps for like cars, and they had to stop accepting like a certain make from Europe, not certain makes, but like cars from after a certain year, because of the amount of pollution that actually adds to that certain to that area. And like, that's literally environmental racism, you know? Like, it's not just about the clothes, it's not just about like where you get your straws from, but it's also where does all the stuff that we consume go? And that's something I genuinely haven't thought about till about 3 years ago. I was like, whoa, we have a lot of waste. And like, it's literally just getting dumped on the other side of Earth, you know? I just think it's crazy. And like, the fact that we think it's acceptable and that we just refuse to hold corporations responsible, and like, we just lift it off to the people, and they're like, you, I can't believe you're not recycling, blah, blah, blah. But really, like, while you're saying this, Shell is actually dumping like a ton of oil somewhere that you will never know, because the ocean is so big and they will get away with it, you know? I just feel it's a very unfair conversation that we're having.
Yeah, and it's so huge, you know? It's like you were saying, we need to have education about these things, but sometimes it feels like, where do you start? Because it's so big, you know? And like, I think one example of it is, I suppose, Pride Month, when we look at the idea of rainbow capitalism and how all these companies that exploit everyone, but once they stick a rainbow on their products, we're like, oh, that's great, they support us. Or if they donate 10% of their products, which doesn't exactly add up to a lot of money for a lot of these organizations. So yeah. And how can the movement for LGBT rights intersect with those movements then, do you think? That's a big question.
In terms of intersecting, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that the LGBT sort of cause or movement for the, kind of the betterment of conditions for us, I don't know if that cause can really exist without, you know, also taking into consideration the experiences of Black people, also taking into consideration the experiences of other people of color, in an Irish context anyway, the experiences of Black people, of other people of color, of the traveling community. You know, all of these things are so contingent upon one another that, you know, like Rima was saying before, we can't really talk about ending racism unless we talk about ending capitalism. We can't talk about ending queerphobia unless we talk about, you know, ending racism, basically. So it's a very, very broad church, that's true. But I think it's really up to an individual to approach it at whatever angle that they feel most comfortable with. So whether that's, you know, approaching it from, you know, learning about the anti-racist struggle, whether that's learning it from, you know, LGBTQ history, whether that's learning it from indigenous cultures around the world, all of these things are interlinked. All of these things are contingent upon one another. So, I mean, it's definitely vast, but it's absolutely an area of research and an area of study that's worth looking into. And it's something that is working towards the liberation of all people. So, you know, it is something that can seem, I don't know if this is a word, but it can seem a bit jargonized at times and it can seem very opaque. But I think what we are trying to do is we're trying to remove that veil. We're trying to, I suppose, fan that smoke away and tell people, you know, this is something that is accessible to you. And it's something that's working towards not just your betterment, but, you know, the betterment of conditions for everybody, you know. So, yeah, it's definitely a vast area of kind of research and thinking and things like that, but yeah, worth getting into and worth approaching from whatever angle that you feel most comfortable with, and then going from then on. Yeah,
well, you've also said in your manifesto that Black liberation can't be realized without queer and trans liberation as well. What do you mean by that in that context?
Well, I think if you've been seeing or like watching whatever's happening in America, you notice that there's a very huge erasure of trans victims and of queer victims, and just an invisibility of like all the queer organizers as well. And it's something that's just, I suppose it's like within the Black community, we find that we are like in another bubble where we have to kind of always dim ourselves and like make ourselves smaller in order to cater to like very much colonial understandings of gender, of sexuality, of love, of like sex, everything, you know. And that's literally one of the main reasons that we started Black Pride, because I was like, I don't want to go to a space anymore and people are just shouting like slurs here and there. Like if I'm out with like a girl or whatever, I don't want to be like harassed or looked at different by a auntie or uncle or whatever. It's not the actual look, but it's the whole idea that represents it, you know. I just feel like if generations are coming in and they feel that they have to hide or they have to like, you know, resort to extreme things just to be themselves, I just do not think that's living. So it's important to sort of highlight the double sort of invisibility that we go through, not like just from the white environment, but from our own family, our own kin, our own blood, and how to negotiate with that, how to find the community within that, and sort of how to make people understand that a lot of the things that we're dealing with are very much products of colonialism. Before colonialism, there was no such thing as like man, woman, and like genders or like what type of marriage. There was a lot of very loose, very like each area had its own thing, you know, and that's fine. Like there's, I just actually like, it gets me mad because I'm like, if colonialism never happened, we wouldn't be having these conversations.
Yeah. Oh, you know? Big difference in the world.
Yeah, there's still indigenous communities that carry these traditions, mm-hmm. and carry these you know, like I suppose social structures that we aren't aware of, and that would be amazing to see in the world, because as I said before, like misogyny cannot like exist, capitalism cannot exist without misogyny, and obviously this is working. Obviously the ostracization of the queer community is working because it benefits them, you know. So we just find ourselves like fighting so many things. We're already fighting a global system, and then we're here, and then we're fighting the white queers from, you know, using the N-word and like making fun of us by like playing characters. And then also in our own homes per se, we're also dealing with this kind of bullshit, you know? So yeah, it's a tough one.
Sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And is there a lot of that in Ireland? I can't even remember last time I was even in a bar. It's been so long, I'm so old and boring. But
no.
No, honestly, your mid-30s, you're just like, everything's old and boring. But the last, I think the last gay bar I was in was the George, and it was very just white males, obviously, you know, for it was the predominant thing. But I think in my teenagers and growing up in Ireland, you know, it was very white, you know, my generation and stuff. And when I went to college, I think it was just 99% white people. Is it a lot more integrated now in the queer scene in Ireland, or is it still very segregated, or what does the reality of it look like?
See, I wouldn't even say segregated, because the community isn't there out on force as you imagine it to be. You know, there's like little pockets of, like, I suppose, like POC or Black queer groups, but there isn't this one big mobile group or like a place that we hang out or like a night out that we can all, you know, congregate and just celebrate each other. So every time we're mostly walking into white spaces, and these white spaces that, like, right, current queer culture, even from before, literally the start of Pride was started by Black trans women. So the culture has been dictated by that, you know? So we're walking in, it's like, hey girl, hey sister, like all these really over familiar, like, you don't know me. Why are you even addressing me? First of all, just because I'm Black, that means you have to talk to me to prove something, you know? Yeah. Like everything is just really uncomfortable. Like, also, like, when you're walking and they just feel like they could touch you or touch your hair, and you're just like, ah, no, like, this is genuinely things we're still dealing with. So every time I'm going to a gay bar, I just know I have to deal with, like, twinks, like, literally harassing me, you know, because there's no other word for it. Like, I try and make it seem insignificant, but it's the truth, you know? But it's even more annoying because they're using something Black Americans gave and, like, throwing it back in our face in a really weird and offensive way. So
like,
yeah,
a combination of tokenism and fetishization.
Yes,
at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Diana, would you have that experience as well?
I mean, I can't say that I have had that experience myself. I'm not one for, you know, sort of clubbing that much. I don't really frequent like social scenes,
which
I'm kind of similar to you, Caroline. I'm not hitting the bars every so often, yeah, you know, but I've definitely spoken to people who, queer Black people who have had experiences, whether it's on these spaces or whether in the digital space, like on dating apps and things like that. And yeah, the frequency of fetishization, is really high. I mean, you know, kind of white Irish gays like hitting up queer Black people and being like, ooh, like how big is it actually? Like, is it actually that, like, what, like, just very kind of,
yeah,
it's taking a sort of safari view of Black people, which of course is rooted in colonization and in colonial stereotypes about Black people and violent stereotypes about Black people that reduce us pretty much down to our bodies and our physicality and sort of the, I don't know, the sort of virile nature of like Black men. And yeah, that all of that goes back to really racist stereotypes that were engendered by, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, and that still persists to this day. And it's something that's manifesting on dating apps. And, you know, people have told both myself and Rayanne these experiences and how harmful they are to them, and how some people have just been driven off these apps entirely because, you know, the amount of abuse that they're getting, the amount of really sort of horrid personal questions about their genitalia that they're getting, which I suppose, you know, you could make an argument and say, you know, oh, that's the nature of the beast, but, you know, these are things that, you know, are rooted in these racist stereotypes, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, because, you know, if it wasn't a Black person, like, you wouldn't be making those assumptions, you wouldn't be prying that way. But yeah, this is something that's definitely still occurring, even today. So, yeah.
Well, I saw some of the signs at the marches, both here and in the US as well, and the UK, wherever I saw them. And there are things such as, like, if you care about Black dick, you should care about Black Lives Matter. And I was like, oh, there's so much wrong with that statement. And I saw people of all colours holding these signs up as well. And I was just thinking, you're literally just reducing people down to their genitals, and that's it. But we see that in porn so much as well, you know, and like porn is a huge, you know, it reflects racism, but it also perpetuates it as well at the same time with, you know, with sites, you know, I'm not going to name them, but yeah, what are your thoughts on those kind of signs? They just seem so abhorrent, like they were stuck in the railings of the US embassy for the march, and I just think that's missing the point on so many different levels.
Oh yeah, it's definitely missing the point. And yeah, it's just reducing Black people down to their genitalia, which is so, so annoying, because there's so much more to the Black experience than, you know, just sexuality. Like, I like to think of the Black experience, not just in Ireland, by the way, but globally as well. I like to think of it kind of like a kaleidoscope. You know, a kaleidoscope has many lenses, it has many ways that you can, well, not many ways, but there are sort of lots of things going on within a framework within the kaleidoscope, and there's lots of things you can look at within it. So, you know, to reduce that experience down to just, you know, how you experience Black people sexually is really, really, it's really ignorant. It's really, it's ignorant. It's totally like objectionable. It's just, it's one of the worst things that you can do. Not only is it ignorant, again, also rooted in those colonial racist stereotypes. But yeah, I mean, those signs, I mean, I don't really know what people were trying to do with those signs, because I mean, what was the end there? Because I don't really see that being a means towards anything. If anything, that's just kind of feeding into the existing narrative around.
That's Black someone like thinking of a witty sign and then not actually thinking of the consequences and the meaning behind it.
I think like that's just proper violence, you know, when you really think about it. These kind of statements have like biracial kids running around here with absolute racist white parents, be it the dad or the mom, whoever, you know, trying to live their best Black lives, but literally have an op who is their blood family, who does not think they are worthy of a lot of the things that they might think other white people would be, you know, like allowed to or whatever. I just think I literally saw a Vine today, a TikTok even, Vine is dead, of this like white mother, and she had all her kids in line.
I just saw this about half an hour ago.
I actually wanted to cry. So she would like, sorry Deanna, because you haven't seen it.
So
she would pan the kid across the camera, and she was like speaking. She was like, so a lot of people say once you go Black, you never go back. And like she stopped and there was a Black kid. And then she put the Black kid aside and was like, well, I don't think so. And the next one was like a white kid. And I'm like, are they like Pokemon apples that you're collecting? Like, these are real kids, you know? Yeah. So sounds like this disturbed me, because somebody would just sleep with a Black man, or a white man will sleep with a Black woman just so they could say they did, just because we're this like exotic, like whatever. Like, I thought colonialism and slavery is over, but it really isn't. It's so insidiously present in our daily life.
But even that expression, once you go Black, you never go back. Do you know, like, even the existence of that is ridiculous. You know, and I think, well, like, Black men are hypersexualized quite a lot, but so have Black women been. And are you familiar with, you know, she was referred to as the Hottentot Venus?
Yes. Sarah G. Bartman, I think.
Yes. But I only learned the other day she was actually exhibited, even the phrase is just horrendous, in Ireland. She was in Limerick and Dublin. And then, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, that's, you'll see the character of a woman who's like extremely voluptuous, and essentially was just toured around Europe. And I think the States as well, as like this example of this exotic Black woman who is very hypersexualized. But, I had no idea that she came to Ireland and that we had that racist history, you know, as part of her experience. But, Black woman being hypersexualized as well is just, you know, you see it in porn and stuff as well. And, frustration.
It's quite icky.
Yeah.
It's just like we're not viewed as human in any regard, whether it's like porn, whether it's dating, whether it's like the economic system, like just there's nowhere where there is humanity involved and like blackness being conflated together, I think. It's very much just an alienating world to live in, because wherever you go, the door is kind of locked. Well, unless you're a billionaire, but I'm sure even then there's still like issues.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they shouldn't exist, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, like Beyonce's experience is very different
yeah.
to the average woman's experience.
Yeah.
God. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys do your best to create joy. So you have your Black Joy for Pride coming up, and I was talking to Albert from Gender RIP and before, and she was saying, yeah, the trans experience is generally perceived as one that's miserable, so she wanted to have trans desirability be a topic of conversation, which generally isn't. So Black Joy is something that has been in a lot of the media, and I know like my Instagram now is full of people saying, here's Black owned businesses, like Irish businesses. I was like, I had no idea that these existed, do you know? And it's just, again, it's like the access to the media and access to publicity and access to, you know, like, yeah, you're like top 10, you know, fashion designers that are in like the Irish Times or whatever. But talk to me about the Black Joy for Pride approach that you have. I know you teamed up with Gender RIP for that as well. Cause it just sounds like that lovely ray of sunshine, in amongst all the misery and chaos.
Mm-hmm. It's a fundraiser. It's a video fundraiser that we're organizing with Gender RIP, where we're just going to ask for submissions from different performers to just give us their input and like sort of monetize that so we can get some funds going from Black for Black trans folk. And I think like the important thing for us to highlight is to give people their flowers while they're here, and not when, you know, something bad has happened or something even worse than that, and then we're like, oh, you know, that's too bad, that's too sad. Like, we need to just kind of be proactive in ensuring that people are having a good quality of life as best as we can. Like with these things, I feel like we're all just like flipping the same $5 in our circles, you know, but like I think that's part of it, sort of just like communal help and communal uplifting and just creating spaces where people can just go and just be, you know. It's very, very rare for a Black person living in Ireland to not walk into a room feeling like you're carrying the weight of like Africa and your whole ancestors with you, you know. So it's just one of those things that we try to do. Obviously with Corona, like, it really, really blocked us from doing what we wanted to do. So these are like little spaces that we're trying to carve out. So we have the movie club as well, and we've been having like meetings and stuff like that to just sort of alleviate that alienation, because we feel it in our own homes, being queer and being, you know, gender non-conforming and whatnot.
Talk to me about the movie club. So that's titled Queer in the Quarantine, which is a great name, by the way.
Thank you.
What kind of movies do you look at for that?
Well, the films that we watch, they kind of run the whole gamut from, I suppose, you know, documentary style pieces to actual kind of feature films. Sometimes we might watch short films, web series as well. We strive to watch a whole range of Black queer media, because unfortunately the sort of representation, and representation shouldn't be, you know, the sort of, you know, natural conclusion of Black liberation or anything like that. You know, it is good to sort of have sort of pieces of media that we can refer to when we're talking about, you know, one of these little lenses in the kaleidoscope of the Black experience. So, yeah, we try to watch a wide variety of films. One film that really jumps out at me that we watched just, I think, after the inception of the movie club was Chocolate Babies, which is a film that's set in New York in the mid or late 90s, I believe, and it sort of follows the stories of a gang, sort of gaggle of like queer Black friends sort of living in New York and kind of navigating the queer scene there. But yeah, we've also looked at, you know, films that are set outside of an American context. So one film that we looked at was The Book of Jasmine, which is by a queer Barbadian director from Barbados. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but it's called The Book of Javelin. That was really, really good as well. So we try to look at, you know, media that has origins in places all over the world, in, you know, all sections of Black diaspora. And yeah, that's kind of what one of the things we wanted to achieve with the movie club, you know, being able to have that variety, but also, like Ryan said, just alleviating the stressors and the, you know, sort of pain and the just real suffering, basically, that, you know, accompanies kind of existing in the world today as a Black person, not least a queer Black person. So yeah, those are kind of the things that we wanted to achieve with the movie club. Yeah,
I think it's also like good for us because I feel we've been like fed that like white trope of queerness and what it looks like so much that we, like I do anyway, I genuinely doubt myself. I'm like, am I really queer? And is this really like what's happening? And am I wrong?
You queer internalize
enough? It. Yeah, exactly. You really internalize it. And you do think that the image of what queer looks like is like a white twink, you know, and you're just like, okay, this is what it is. And I'm going to, you know, hold on to that and leave. But really, that's not true. Like, it comes in many, like, beautiful shades and varieties, and like there's so much more to it than we can even discuss. So I think just seeing something tangible in that way is also a good way of sort of consolidating between ourselves and like the violence the world enacts on us.
Yeah. Do you think that, you know, obviously one of the, well, the main, maybe not the main, but the, one of the biggest representations of queerness in the media is like RuPaul's Drag Race, and you know that that has its own pros and cons. But what about more in depth, like series? Like, do you, did you watch Pose on Netflix?
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that? For anyone who doesn't know, it's like set in, well, I'll let you explain if you want to. If you're going to explain it better than me.
It's set in the '80s, like in the wake of the AIDS crisis in New York, and it centers a group of. What are they called? A house. House with Vangelis and like a bunch of other houses. But it's basically set in like the ballroom scene in the, in New York. And it's really good. I love it, me personally, but
yeah. Billy Porter is, yeah, he's amazing. Absolutely. Was it refreshing to see that kind of visibility? Like, it's trans people being played by actual trans people and not cis people. So that bit in itself is different. But
seeing like Black people, like the thing about Pose is it's not necessarily about them being Black, it's also about them being Black and queer, and also living in such a horrible time in New York where they were like very much marginalized and very much like a point of contention for a lot of different agencies that make up the USA. But the stories and the humanity and the love that they still bring forth is just so refreshing to see. And it's almost like a blueprint for what we want to see and like feel here. Because we've, like, as I said, we're very much small community. And still with that, the way the transport is set up in Ireland and the way the rent market is set up in Ireland, like realistically, we're not going to be together within the next 6 months, you know, not as much as we'd like to be. But seeing that that can kind of exist, and also just getting to watch a show where people are familiar, you know, that's just different. I haven't even watched season 3 yet because I feel like I can't do anyone watching season 1 and 2. But yeah, I definitely, like, that kind of show was very, very important for me, and I'm sure it is for many other people.
But that visibility is so important. Do you know, I talked to Aoife and Noah in the last couple of podcasts ago of like just that trans visibility in the media is just so important. And so yeah, when you're adding in all those different intersections into it as well, it's super important. But talk to me about the Pride Inside that you're running, because that's going to be a lovely marker of visibility as well. Unfortunately inside because of coronavirus, but you're still determined to go ahead, thankfully.
Oh yeah, we're still chugging ahead with that. So Pride Inside is a collaboration of several prides, not just ourselves and Kerry Pride, like Sligo Pride, Galway Pride, and a few other kind of prides out in rural locations in Ireland. And we found that to be very important because the work we're doing, we kind of want to, you know, we wanted to extend beyond the pale. You know, it's so easy to sort of do everything in Dublin. You know, Dublin is kind of like the social, cultural, economic center of the country. And yet, you know, this kind of leaves everybody else who doesn't live in Dublin at a disadvantage. And like Rayanne was saying, you know, the infrastructure isn't necessarily there for people who are in rural communities, who are, you know, living far away from the capital. There isn't really that much, there isn't many provisions in place to kind of have them be able to engage with Pride events in Dublin. So yeah, you know, unfortunately due to the pandemic, we've sort of been forced inside, but yeah, we wanted this to be something that caters to, you know, the entire island of Ireland, which is something that we point out in our manifesto. This isn't something that's going to be concentrated in the Pale by any means. But yeah, it's an event that is running from the 11th of July to the 19th. And it's going to see sort of, you know, a lot of events. There's there's reams of events going on. You know, there's quizzes, there's panels, there are other discussions, there are raffles, prizes being given away. And yeah, it's sort of a novel collaboration for us because, you know, we've never collaborated with this many people at the one time, but we think it's an important opportunity. And we'll be holding a panel on the 14th of July, Tuesday the 14th of July, if I remember correctly. And that will be with other queer Black people who also are from rural areas or are living in rural areas at the minute. And yeah, we're really excited to be working with Kerry Pride and with the other Prides as well. And it's something that I'm very much looking forward to. So hopefully we'll see lots of people tune in for that, yeah.
Yeah, so much pride is in Dublin itself, so it's just lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's having a lot more, yeah, openness as well.
And oh, definitely. Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
And then what's next for Black Pride after Pride? what are your future plans, or are they top secret?
Well, not really, but I mean, August is actually Black Pride Month, so we'll definitely be doing a lot of things, just sort of focusing on our community directly. And sort of just uplifting our voices, because as great as Pride Month is, I think it's been obvious why we don't feel very welcomed. You know, it's like starting your own party, then getting kicked out of it, and then being like forced, like lured to come back in with the belief that everything's great and like nice, but it's really just not, and very much racist and very much corrupt and very much corporate, which is not something we align ourselves to, you know? So even we've been asked to like speak about Pride and whatnot, but I'm like, we weren't even going to be at Pride. We were going to be alternative Pride, you know,
exactly,
where
yeah.
our like voices are actually heard, because why are we going to like walk behind floats and like the guards and RTE? Like, no, thank you. No, thanks.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think just focusing on the betterment of our community and just rejoicing, you know. I think we've had a lot of trauma and we've had a lot of grief, and the collective is definitely feeling it. I am anyway, so I'm gonna
me too.
But yeah, I think that's gonna be our focus for.
And is that an international month or just in Ireland?
No, that's like international.
Okay, wow. And see, again, that's my ignorance of not knowing that. Like, I knew about Black History Month in the US, which I thought was February. But I didn't know that. So yeah, I have a lot of learning to do. I have tons of learning to do, especially as a white person, just to be like, let's go for that. So, brilliant. Like, you guys are just doing, just amazing work. And I'm so happy that that exists in Ireland and we're finally, hopefully, on the right path. And, you know, hopefully that there is that kind of level of support there as well. Where can people find you if they want to get involved, if they want to support you? I know, because you do talks and workshops as well, but you have social media presences too.
Mm-hmm.
So we have got, I'm pulling up our socials because, you know, Black Pride IRE on Twitter. And then we are also Black Pride IRE on Instagram. And then we've got an email, which is hiblackprideire@gmail.com. We're around, you know, email us if you want to collab. Please don't hit us up on Instagram for anything serious, because that's a scary place. Twitter is a scary place.
Very frightening. Yeah. We also have a recently launched website, which is blackprideireland.ie. So, you know, big shout out to the person who designed it. You know who you are. But yeah, that was recently launched. That has a directory of resources that we think are really important for people to learn more, not just about the anti-racist struggle and Black liberation, but also about DP. We've got the Asylum Archive up there by the artist Vukasin Nedeljkovic. We also have links to Merge, to gender.rip, and to Mazi as well. So, yeah, there's a directory, a copy of our manifesto, and also an events calendar just to check if there's anything that people might be interested in attending themselves, you know, whether that's in the digital space or in real life, when we're allowed to engage with things in real life again. At some point, in the nebulous future.
We'll get there. And do you have a place where people can donate as well if they want to support financially?
So we actually are not accepting any more donations because we have more money that we can like actually deal with.
So
we that's lovely, but
it's a good thing. Thank you for trying. But if you could redirect your focus to Origins Ella, which is origins.ella on Instagram, they have a PayPal set up there, or Mazi, or Merge is also not donating. So yeah, those two organizations would be the best to go to.
Brilliant. Okay. And do you have personal social medias that you want people to follow, or you just want to get people over to Black Pride? Don't want to deal with it. That's no problem at all. Listen, thank you so much to the two of you for talking to me today.
Thanks so much for having us, Caroline.
I'm so happy you're doing the work that you're doing, and I, you know, hopefully you'll change the world, because I can see it in you. Your generation will change the world. I sound like such an old fart when I say that, but it's true.
Thank you for that. That means a lot.
Absolutely. And yeah, and I absolutely encourage all my listeners, you know, to go check you out and support in whatever way that they can. And even if it's not financial, there's still like likes and retweets and shares and all those approaches as well. So thank you to both. Thank you to all my listeners for listening in today. If you like the podcast, pop over to iTunes and rate and review. If you like us on Spotify, you can follow, so that way you're up to date with the latest episodes as well. If you really, really like us, you can pop over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack to help us keep the mics on. And we're on Twitter at glow_west_, and Instagram is glowwestinsta, all one word. So I look forward to chatting to you next week. Bye.